Good morning. It is another Friday, and that means another edition of the Zogby Report, real and unscripted. Although this week it's partially scripted because we had an election on Tuesday, and obviously we're going to comment on that because I've been asked to comment on the election in previous days, and I'm going to share with you some of my notes plus some new thoughts. And I'm here again, as always, with my son and partner, Jeremy. Hey.
Hey, good to be back. And that was a nice Amy Coney Barrett move right there.
It's my role model, okay?
And so I guess I've got some notes, too, that it's okay. I can use them if I need to.
So welcome to the Zogby Report, real and partially scripted.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, obviously we had an election on Tuesday, and it was an earthquake in many ways. The principal races that we looked at, you know, were certainly Virginia, and rather unexpectedly, New Jersey. And so we're going to talk about that. Before we get into the discussion of Virginia, I just want to tell everyone, and you will be reminded of this, not only during the podcast, but in an email next week, that we have a very special guest again, our third guest, another author, Tom Galvin, longtime friend, colleague, client, who has written a wonderful novel called The Auction about the year 2050. And the dangers of giant corporate control over our lives using technology to spy and actually even direct us, and then the social and personal impact that that has on young people in particular. It is a wonderful read. It is a version of 1984, but not written as dark and as stark as 1984. It's a very engaging read. As everyone knows, Glenn Youngkin's won in Virginia. Partially expected. The polls were very close. They were trending towards Youngkin's and away from Terry McAuliffe. So no real surprise, except let's just say that for the president and for the Democrats in general, it ended up being a kick in the pants. Mm-hmm. Virginia is an important bellwether. It's always the first major election, odd number year, after a presidential race, and so it has meaning. And of late, in the last couple of decades, it has gone against the incumbent president of the United States. But I think what makes the recent election so poignant is the fact that New Jersey, which if you're using or recalling your box of crayons, Crayola crayons, is about as navy blue, right, yeah, as a state can get. That was really the earthquake. Yeah. And in tandem, Virginia, which has really been blue in the last decade, plus New Jersey, was a very powerful message to the Dems. I want to share with you some of the thoughts that I shared the day after the election. And that is obviously that the Democrats at this moment in time have a huge problem. And I've summed it up very briefly in the following way. Number one, is the Democrats have not, with the exception of 2018, have not mastered the art of turning out their base in off-year elections. Once again, as in 2010, 2014, and to some degree as well 2016, the electorate in those elections, off-year elections, not 2016, but in the off-year elections, is whiter, older, and much more conservative than in presidential elections. That's a problem. Number two is that traditionally Republicans score on defense and national security, at times on the economy, and the so-called softer issues, healthcare, education, the environment, are bailiwicks for the Democrats. This year, Republicans own the issue of education. And it's not reading, writing, and arithmetic. It is far different. It's the issue in general of parental control.
Yeah.
Who's going to make decisions? It's about masks. It's about critical race theory. And it's about anti-elitism. And Democrats are finding themselves more and more painted into the elitist, we will decide for you corner. They're helping to paint that themselves. Thirdly, their problem is they need a legislative victory. And there really is not a prospect for a legislative victory. And this is one of those compounding problems, because at a point in time, it looked as if all the sides in the major pieces of legislation, right, the hard infrastructure, the softer spending infrastructure, were working towards a deal. And yet what we had in the recent 10 days is a blow up of that. The president really needed a victory before he went to Europe and on a world stage, where he's about to lecture the rest of the world and deliver the United States to the rest of the world, and he can't, because he couldn't get a victory and a secure position on the environment in this case. But the bottom line here is that the president has expressed a vision, and then from there has been saying, I'm guaranteeing a deal. We're coming to a deal. We have a framework for a deal. We're inches from a deal. And his words are becoming hollow. Regardless of whose fault it is, it's a Democrat problem right now. That leads into the fourth. There are five of these. The fourth issue. And that harkens back to a book that I think everybody should read. 25 years ago or more, Samuel Popkin, the rational voter, said that whether voters articulate it in their own words or not, when they go to the polls, they are asking two questions. What have you done for me lately? And what will you do for me next? And right now, that column is empty on the Democrats' side. And that's where a lot of frustration is. A year ago, Joe Biden won handsomely. He won New Jersey and Virginia handsomely. And look at what's happened. And then the fifth and the final problem, no surprise here, and we've talked about this a lot. Democrats are hopelessly split. And they still are. Not only the day after the election did Joe Manchin say, I can't support this legislation. Bernie Sanders said, I cannot not support this legislation. They are not inches away from a deal. That's a major problem that we have. Finally, I would say, and this is not related to the Democrats' problem, but essentially, we have a very proactive white backlash in the United States. What I mean by that is that dating back to book before the 2008 election, The Coming Democratic Majority, the authors, Ree Teixeira and John Judis, pointed out that if you look at the demographics that are growing in the United States, it is all of those population groups that are loyal to the Democrats, been voting Democrat, eventually elected Barack Obama, reelected him twice. And that's true. Young people, people of color, Asian Pacific Americans, Latino Americans, Black Americans, young women, all of those groups are growing. The one thing that they didn't take into consideration was the fact that there's stuff that happens. And the thing that they didn't project, and this is my final point, is that there is a white backlash. There is a fear of a United States changing and being in a different position on the world stage. And this is kind of like, I used to call it a death rattle, but I think it's even bigger than that. It is the last vestiges of a majority that's becoming a minority, but is very intense and will turn out to vote. That's a long one, and I apologize if you're listening, but tell me what you're thinking.
Well, there's a lot of overlap in what I'm going to say with it, as always, in 92 episodes with a different take, a different twist, but this is the making of a novel, of a big novel, right? And so Dickens wrote A Tale of Two Cities. This is a tale of a city and a state. So the backdrop is amazing. The city, of course, is Glasgow, COP26. You have that going on as you know, the we could say the theme of global sovereignty, or a slow march towards away from national sovereignty and towards global sovereignty. We need to work together. Nations need to work together. Maybe even the possibility of a global government, as you know, big thinkers within that crowd talk about and write about, versus the state being Virginia. And so, you know, I think the thing that screams out when you're wondering what's going on here is that old maxim that all politics is local, right? So if you're a Virginia voter and your bread and butter is a job where you have to commute anywhere from 45 minutes to 90 minutes, maybe even more, and that's your job and that's how you make your money, and you say to yourself, well, I can't really control the climate. What can I really do about CO2? You know, chances are they're probably not going to drive a gas guzzler if it's 90 minutes, back and forth. That's too expensive. And a lot of Americans are feeling that pinch. And so maybe they've bought a hybrid, maybe they bought an electrical car, and some of them are saying, well, I did my part. I bought more of an economical car, but the weather and the climate and all of that is out of my control. And so that's being discussed at the national level, and that's being discussed at the global level, especially in Glasgow. But what can I control? And you alluded to this. I can control, potentially, what goes in my kid's head and potentially what goes in my kid's body. And so this is exactly what happened when, if people are surprised that there was a flip, and a considerable flip. I mean, we're talking about a 5-point spread. Mm-hmm. And in Virginia, and of course, independence had a major thing to do with that. Biden had won Virginia with, I believe, independence 10% more.
More, yeah.
And he basically lost a lot of that. So it had to do with independence, who were seeing what was going on and were saying, I can have more impact on what goes on in my community. All politics is local. So the Democrats came out strong when Biden was elected. He had his mandate. And the Democratic strategy was somewhere between global and national. So at the global level, build back better, right? Mm-hmm. That's a global thing. That's discussed by the UN, the European Union, the IMF, Justin Trudeau, Boris Johnson, Joe Biden. And it was, we're going to ram this legislation through. Of course, there were national mandates, mask mandates, vaccine mandates. And so I think what the Republicans saw, right, like anything that's strong and momentous and powerful, there's always an Achilles heel. And so I think the Republicans, because remember, from Trump, it was all about nationalism. It was all about national sovereignty, the border. Mm-hmm. We have to make America great again. Let's bring the factories home. Let's build up the country. And so in Virginia, the strategy became all politics is local, where it was the reaction to, as you said, critical race theory. It was the disgust with the fact that the FBI were listening in on some of these school boards, and parents felt like, hey, like, isn't this a basic right of mine? And then as we talked about the vaccine mandates, and actually I have some poll numbers from a poll that we did recently, and two of the questions had to deal with what we're talking about. One was, it's a Zogby poll of 1,000 parents of young children defined as under 12, obviously in the nation. Regarding your kid wearing a mask, is it more up to the parent or is it more up to the school district? 48% of parents said it's more up to the parent. 42% said it's more up to the school district. I find that fascinating, because that 6-point spread is basically what the Virginia spread was, right, in the governor race. And then another question had to do with, and you know, you're hearing this a lot more, and this is fascinating. People are chanting out on the streets, "My body, my choice." And so the question goes, regarding the COVID-19 vaccine, regardless of whether you took the vaccine or whether you didn't, which do you side more with? It's my body, it's my choice, or government mandates should be requiring Americans to take it. 57% sided with my body, my choice versus 33. That's almost 2-1. And so that's playing out the national level. That's what happened in Virginia. It's all tied together, but at the end of the day, all politics is local.
I don't disagree with a lot of that. And to underscore what you pointed out, this is with us now. This is the issues that you lay out about parental control, my body, myself, a rejection of being told, especially by a force or by forces that are seen as not only too big, but also untrustworthy. And trust was kind of like underscored on Tuesday, lack of trust and anti-elitism. And the fact that the Republicans now seem to have taken control of politics on a local level is very important, because in between now and next November, and this is another Democratic problem, you're going to have school board elections all over the country. And we can see by the intensity that parents are going to challenge school boards, run for school boards on these very issues, probably win on a lot of these issues, and then carry that momentum forward. It's almost like a runaway train. As I look into 2022, into November, honestly, it's hard to see at this point in time Democrats keeping a majority. Obviously, anything can happen.
Yeah.
But we're not even talking on a macro level. We're talking on a micro level. A lot of this activity is taking place everywhere. It's taking place among blacks and in the cities. But the focal point is in suburbs. And as you pointed out, Democrats took a shellacking in the suburbs, took a shellacking among independents, forces that Joe Biden had won just a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, there was the Achilles heel. It was revealed and it was attacked. And I think we've already seen, Kamala Harris made a statement that I thought was very telling. She said Virginia is a bellwether. So she is acknowledging, without saying it directly, the mistake of the Democrats. But, you know, I mean, between Van Jones and another journalist on MSN, immediately the reaction is, you know, this is racism. This is whiteness. And I mean, I don't want to get into that debate. Of course, I suppose the Virginians could say, we elected the first black official at the state level in the state's history with the lieutenant governor. I know she's definitely not anywhere near a moderate or, a centrist. I don't think so.
She isn't. She's very conservative.
But nonetheless, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that the Democrats would do much better, instead of trying to excuse it or trying to react to it or trying to label it, is to take a look at themselves, go back to the drawing board, and say, what can we do different? You know, maybe the first three quarters of Joe Biden didn't play out so well. Maybe we've got to clean up our own backyard. I mean, we've got this big rift in the party between the squad and between, you could say, the establishment. And they need to rework it. How do we present it better so that this doesn't happen again, instead of labeling it? And I think they could very well turn this around very easily.
So all roads lead to Donald Trump on this, whether he's a factor or not a factor. But what's very interesting to me, you know, I mentioned it at the outset that it was an older, whiter, more conservative crowd. So a year ago, 20% of the electorate was 18 to 29 years old. Last Tuesday, 10% of the electorate was. Now, that's not uncommon in off-year elections and in congressional and elections. But why, after all that we know and all that we've been through, and the strong suggestion that I obviously subscribe to, is that there was an insurrection and a near revolution, all-out treason, I'm going to call it, on January 6th, and yet the Democratic base didn't turn out? That's number one. And number two, among those who did turn out, among 18 to 29-year-olds, instead of a double-digit difference, a 16, 17-point difference between the Democrat and the Republican, there was a 7-point difference. McAuliffe won, but did not win. Youngkin got 46% of that vote. Typically, a Republican gets 35, 36%. Mm. Secondly, this is very, very important. Among blacks, and there was a lower turnout, again, this does not appear to be an impressive number, but Youngkin received 13% of the black vote. That's deadly.
Yeah.
We've talked about that before.
Yeah.
That normally does not go above 10%.
Yeah.
And when you think that Democrats need every black vote that they can get, they're coughing up and losing out on those black votes. So did Glenn Youngkin put together a winning formula by, on one hand, pivoting toward and embracing Donald Trump, but then, I'm using basketball terminology, shift back and say, I don't want Donald Trump to come in. This is a local race I'm running. I just don't want to alienate Trump's people, but I want to go to the center to some degree. Is there a road to victory for Republicans on a national scale, finessing or without Donald Trump?
That is the million-dollar question, and I often think about that. On the one hand, I see Trump as a potential liability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people think that DeSantis is on the rise and that DeSantis can take over MAGA, but I mean, we still have a ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's too difficult to tell, but I think it's bigger than Trump. You know, this goes back to the Tea Party, right? What we saw play out in Virginia, in the suburbs and in those key counties, if we look at it short term, we say, oh, well, this is just Trumpism. This is just MAGA. Actually, it's not. It goes back to the Tea Party. It goes further back than that. This is quintessential democracy in America, right? And what I mean by that, of course, is the one of the greatest books ever written about this country by a French observer who came here in, I believe, in the 1830s. He actually was right over there in Utica observing American life and said, you know, the uniqueness and the strength of America are these civic organizations. It's not so much that the people, like in Europe, have this feudal mentality where they're reliant upon the nobility and they're reliant upon the monarchy. The Americans go to the streets and they form charities, they form their own educational organizations. You have women's group, you have men's group, you have religious groups, and they're self-reliant. And so I think it's bigger than Trump. Trump is a demagogue, and he can rile people up, and he can do that. But at the end of the day, this is something that I think is quintessentially American, that I can have an effect in my community and in a world where we're getting sucked into a vortex that a lot of people feel they can't control. That is something that they control. So, I mean, that's how I see it.
Democrats have a lot to be concerned about. There needs to be a whole lot of soul searching. I'm going to be honest with you, as a Democrat, I'm not so sure, A, that they get it, or B, that they know what to do. It seems as if you alluded to this, there has to be a massive listening tour. That's what campaigns are supposed to be anyway. Not speechification, but listening. And apparently not, or at least it's not working. So in the final analysis, this is ongoing, and we're going to be talking about this quite a bit, but this was a jolt.
Yeah, and let me be fair, right, because I don't want to make it sound all glorious for the Republicans. I'm of the opinion that when the Democrats came to power, they got a little drunk on their power. And I'm going to warn the Republicans, Virginia is a big win for you, and there's a lot of momentum in Virginia. And even though they didn't win in New Jersey, the fact that they almost won is almost a victory in itself when you throw in Virginia in the mix. But don't get ahead of yourselves.
No.
Don't start to think that this is the mandate is upon you. That's just the nature of hubris. And you saw what happened to the Democrats when they were hubristic. Don't go down that path.
A part-time truck driver beat the Senate Majority Leader, State Senate Majority Leader in New Jersey. Republican beat a Democrat. Republican spent $153 in that race. Think about it.
Yeah.
Again, a reminder that our guest next week will be Tom Galvin, a superior writer, formerly with the New York Post and the New York Daily News, and a communications expert who knows firsthand the giant tech companies. He's worked on their behalf for decades and is now an author about the future and what could very well happen just around the corner. That's our guest next week, and we'll see you for the next edition.